You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Ruben McLaren tōku ingoa, nō mai hare mai ki te wai mō tēnā rā. Kia ora, welcome to The Wire for Monday the 9th of April. I'm joined in studio by Lucy Austin and Mary Margaret Slack. How are your weekends?
Pretty good, thanks.
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's 10 days till my birthday.
Ooh, We're both April babies.
Yeah.
Taurus is in the house.
Oh, yeah.
I'm Aries.
Oh, whoops.
So were you put forward in school? Or how
yeah, I was put forward in school. That's from a young girl.
Oh, right. Well, what did you get up to?
I went to a gig, a cassette with a band that my friends liked called Sea Views. I hadn't seen them before, but they were amazing. The drummer, who I actually think was a fill-in, she was so talented, but they're about to go on a worldwide tour. So if you're out there in the worldwide airwaves, look out for them.
Did you get one of those cassette teapots?
No, I didn't. I didn't have enough money, so I did all my preloading.
They're just total rip off. Cool. So on the show today, I have a chat to newly elected Greens co-leader Marama Davidson. Lucy Austin speaks about New Zealand's prospects with Brexit on the horizon and what it could mean for trade and our economy. She has a chat to Trade, Finance and Economic Development Minister David Parker to find out more. It's Wire Worry Week and we're focusing on public transport. Mary Margaret speaks to Auckland Councillor Richard Hills about the regional fuel tax and what it will do for the transport system. And we also have Southern Cross with Jean Bell in studio, where we'll get a rundown on the big stories from the Asia Pacific region. If you have any thoughts you'd like to share, send us a text on 5395 or give us a call on 309 3879.
The Wire. Sitting on the beach watching transnational criminal scum neoliberal filth.
First up, I have a chat to the new Greens co-leader Marama Davidson about what her leadership will mean for the party, how the Greens will hold the government to account, and what is to be made from Immigration New Zealand's alleged racial profiling. So, to start off with, congratulations on your successful bid for co-leader.
Kia ora, Ruben, thank you.
Does this mean that the Greens, under your leadership, co-leadership, will never partner with National?
It's been a popular question this morning, and we're not even thinking about that right now because we've only been in government for 6 months, and we're really focused, and I'm really focused on achieving the working with Labour, actually. We've got enough to achieve with Labour, and so it's just not something that is, you know, even relevant at this particular time. We've got enough to do in our program of delivering our confidence and supply priorities and our ministerial priorities, which are part of that as well. So that's where my focus is, because, you know, I don't know where the discussion is coming from about working with National, but it's not something that's going to happen right now or probably even down the line either.
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of push by the media for it because it's quite a saucy subject. You come from a background of activism and have a strong grassroots backing and have also made your opinions quite clear on the failings of our economic system.
Yay!
So, under your co-leadership, will we see the Greens moving more to the left?
What we will see is my connections to those grassroots and activist campaigns be a strong feature under my, because I am co-leader, and that is the background that I've come from, and I've been voted in on a mandate to continue to stand up for the very values that I've long held. And so whatever it means, where I'm going to keep talking about the daily realities of the hardships that people are facing, in my own community, and I have to talk about these things because in my own community, where people are living on the streets or living in unsafe, unhealthy rentals and being charged through the roof for really cruel, shitty houses. I have to talk about all of those things that affect our people every day, and so I will continue to talk up on those values. And yep, that makes me left. I'm proud to continue to keep talking about what needs to change and what is happening every day in ordinary people's lives at the moment.
Will we start to hear terms that have long been sidestepped in politics, like the term socialism? Will we hear that out of your mouth?
I will continue to talk in a way that just ordinary people understand, and what people want to hear is that we get the fact that families are having to hold two, three, more than one job just to pay the rent. What we continue to hear is that children are being admitted to hospital from completely preventable diseases because of the condition of their house. And what we will, and what I will continue to stand up for, is making sure that government funding is returned for to our health system, education, housing. Middlemore Hospital, for crying out loud, has got mould and sewage running through its walls because of a flawed economic system that focuses on economic on surplus instead of making sure that the hospitals are okay. And so that's how I will talk, and the labels don't mean a lot to me, and so I doubt that they mean a lot to most people. I will talk about the daily realities and what that means in human terms.
Last month we saw the Greens move to allocate a lot of their question time, that give some of their allocated question time to National. What did you agree with that?
Yes, I did at the time, and also because we've held on to being able to ask questions to keep the government to account. And as a co-leader, a non-minister co-leader, I will be able to prioritise asking those questions. And so we still hold on to being able to keep the government to account and use our questions for that purpose.
Well, considering the questions asked by National come from a very different ideological position as the Greens, do you think this move may actually limit the ability for the Greens to hold the government to account? I mean, considering, I mean, you, a lot of time has been given to them.
Yeah, and so I see, and so where it has come from is our one of our goals around open democracy, and actually whether it's National or whoever it is in opposition, it's about making sure that whoever is in opposition will be using questions, that questions should be used to keep government to account. So it's not just about National. But yes, we have given questions over to them. It's come from the Greens wanting to do politics a different way. I understand there's been some angst about that, and I take that on board, and it means that I have to make sure even more so that we're holding on to our questions to keep government to account as well.
So now let's talk about the data modelling pilot that Immigration New Zealand has been running over the past 18 months. They're using age, gender and ethnicity to determine which overstayers are most likely to run up hospital bills and commit crime so they can be deported. Some people have called this process racial profiling, and Green Party immigration spokesperson Golriz Garaman has expressed her concerns to the immigration minister and claims that it is in clear breach of the Human Rights Act.
Yeah.
When we tried to interview Golriz about this, we were told it was too sensitive a topic to discuss. So my question to you is, why haven't we heard more from the Greens about this?
And I think, given that I'm probably going to refer it to Golriz as our spokesperson, but I take on board a lot of the commentary that is out there at the moment that this is profiling on a number of levels, and I think we need to seriously think about whether or not this is going to actually be racial profiling, and if it is, there are some clear human rights breaches. And so I know that Golriz, as spokesperson, is continuing to have conversations with the responsible minister over this.
It seems as though, well, Golriz didn't feel like she could or wasn't allowed to, or simply didn't want to speak about this, at least at this point in time. Can you maybe give any explanation about
that? It's certainly understandable that we want to talk with our partners and talk with our ministers across the parties, and, you know, and have those discussions. I think that's respectful and it's upholding our relationship. And so allowing for Golriz Garaman as spokesperson to be able to have those conversations.
Okay. And if it is found to be in breach of the Human Rights Act and there is no government back down on this, how will you, as co-leader, hold the government to account?
And that's another example of where we can use those questions in the House to be able to ask the minister to explain what is going on here with the Immigration New Zealand Department. And the Greens, you know, in our clause was an agree to disagree, and it's a responsibility that the members put in place specifically so we could have a confidence and supply agreement that we could live with. And so if that is going to be a point of difference, we, and me as a non-minister co-leader, will be able to speak about where the Greens' positions, where our values are. And we've been pretty clear generically that we disagree with racial profiling, with any profiling really.
So one of the reasons given for giving some of the allocated question time to National was to stamp down on patsy questions. But what was stopping, you're saying you're prepared to ask the tough questions to the government, but what was stopping you previously?
No, we could always do that previously, but I can still do that, and so we weren't seeking to change that, absolutely. And a patsy question is different from asking a tough question. We're still maintaining that we'll ask the tough questions. That hasn't changed. A patsy question was seen to take a lot of time and resource and capacity, and that it would be better used for opposition to keep government to account. And so that's where the decision for that came from.
Oh, so really you were hoping it would be National that would ask the patsy questions?
No, the questions were given for National to ask to keep government to account. Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Okay. And regarding this and your leadership, is there anything else you'd like to add?
Oh, just, I'm really humbled by the mandate that was given, but it means that I have a massive responsibility to stay really loud and clear and bring those voices who feel they're often unheard into my leadership, co-leadership position and into the negotiations and the policies that we put in place. And that's what I'm going to continue to do in this leadership role.
I wish you luck in that, Marama.
Kia ora.
Thank you.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
Did you vote for the Greens? How do you feel about the new leadership? Give us a text on 5395 or give a call on 309-3879. We've had a couple of texts in. Richard says, could you ask the government to make changes to immigration into New Zealand, especially Auckland, as we didn't make plans for this crazy influx and now look at the situation we are in? Sure, I'm sure someone will ask the question. Another text, I feel that Marama expresses my thoughts and ideas that I feel are important. She represents my voice in our democracy. We'll be right back after a song.
Yeah, this one here goes out to Riversdale Park, Avondale, for all the snot news kids. Check. Basketball court tells my life without no more talk. Footprints still in the floor from where my force walk. Memories still in my thoughts, I'm back and forth. Forming chalk still drawn up on the wall for the scoreboard. And in the breeze, I hear the old wind kicking leaves as I sit in trees, watching little me's hitting threes. I smell the tar seal burning in the summer sun. A mountain bubble gum mixed with burning rubber from my bike's back. Tiger leaving marks on the park. Car park ponds had my name carved in their bark. Blood stains remain like my first tattoo, written in the concrete with a piece of bamboo. And I go back now and again to get up out of my head and think about it at the hours I spent. And I can hear the ball bouncing again, and sometimes I can even hear the sound of the net. Like just walking through the street with nothing on our feet, just snotty little kids playing 5-on-5, sitting in the dark with the bums in the park and the bottle on the bench on a Friday night, chilling with myself, just me and no one else, looking at the world from the 3-point line, from 3 feet all the way to 24, basketball court, it knows my life. Now as the days flew, the same hoop was where we came to. Same crew, same old sways, but they were spray blue. Same view, nothing had changed, just the chains new. And the tape played break loose for us to break to. The same moon would light the court every night like a torch, while the old folk called their kids in from by the porch. And you can tell the ones who grew up here, cause they used the gear they go, the brothers used to wear like a souvenir. It's like we do a loop. I'm looking at my new recruit playing on the same hoop where we used to shoot. And now we sit up on the park bench skipping mass, sipping Jack where we sat in the days picking scabs. Sitting back in the pitch black as I reminisce on every switch, missing every shot I ever miss. And I remember still, ain't forgotten, probably never will, the day I bet well 7-0. It's real. Just walking through the the street with nothing on our feet. Just snotty little kids playing 5-on-5. Sitting in the dark with the bums in the park and the bottle on the bench on a Friday night. Chilling with myself, just me and no one else. Looking at the world from the 3.9. From 3 feet tall all the way to 24. Basketball court, it knows my life. To play, been bulldozed away. Now the only stain from the olden day, and the marks on the bar from the rollerblades, and the fingerprints left on the blackboard. A black wall and a flat ball. But that's all. It's no more lights, no more fights. So who's like Mike? And no games that go all night. It's no more life. I'll pick up a rock and take a jump shot that I once got from that one spot. And I remember how it felt being young as I count. 3, 2, 1. I guess one day we all gotta end the game. I never would've made the NBA anyway, but I'll never let my memory fade. And whenever I play, I remember the day. Just walking through the street with nothing on our feet. Just snotty little kids playing 5-on-5. Sitting in the dark with the bums in the park and the bottle on the bench on a Friday night. Chilling with myself, just me and no one else. Looking at the world from the 3.9. From 3 feet tall all the way to 24. Basketball court, it knows my life.
People just love getting naked.
Excuse me, waiter, there's a fly in my soup.
Ah, zut alors! That is nothing, sir. There is food on my breakfast. C'est très vite! Ah, not since the great...
Food on breakfast. Breakfast, food. It's breakfast food with Delaney Mears. Too many marrows? Trouble pronouncing prosciutto? Send your food questions to Ask Delaney at 95bfm.com to have them chewed over by a real expert. Breakfast Food with Delaney Mears, only on 95bfm. Tune in every Thursday on Breakfast. Food.
Now it's time for the Southern Cross with Kendall Hutt.
Yes, it's time for the Southern Cross, but with Jean Bell, not Kendall Hutt, we need to sort that sting out. Jean Bell is a contributing editor to the Pacific Media Centre. Jean will be giving a rundown of the latest news from the Asia Pacific region later in the show. But today she's also joined by AUT students Hale Ikumotu, sorry if I butchered that, and Blessing Tom, who will be heading to Fiji next week as part of the Bearing Witness program. How are all of us today?
Good, thank you.
Yeah. Really good, thank you.
Great to have you in. So, Hale and Blessing, could you tell us a bit more about the Bearing Witness Project?
Yeah, so the Bearing Witness Project is a two-week
journalism project in Fiji, and it's based around climate change. So it's through the Pacific Media Center at AUT, and we'll be based with the team at the University of the South Pacific and working with their student newspaper, One Solwara. And we'll also be working with the Pacific Center for Environment and Sustainable Development. So yeah, this is the third year that it's running, and Blessing and I are really, really excited.
Yeah, cool. So is it normally just two AUT students that go over and do this?
Yep, normally two AUT students.
Great. And yeah, so when are you leaving? When? Sorry?
We are leaving this Saturday.
This Saturday, so. Cool.
Yeah, pretty excited.
Awesome. So yeah, what exactly are you going to be doing there?
So this is a pretty amazing opportunity for young media students like us to go into Fiji and report on climate change stories. So basically we'll be centered at USP, and with their guidance we'll go into places and report climate change stories and how it impacted on people's lives over there.
Right. And how can a project like Bearing Witness help in climate change issues in the Pacific?
I mean, more than ever, I think journalists have a responsibility to be reporting on climate change issues. It's becoming bigger. With all these storms happening and earthquakes and sea levels constantly rising, people are losing their homes, people are losing their lives, and it's so important that journalists are reporting on these issues. People in the Pacific have such a strong connection to their land, and the truth of the matter is mainstream media isn't reporting on climate change. And I think a project like Bearing Witness really gives us the opportunity to be reporting the truth around climate change genuinely. I think a project like this really emphasizes the need to report on climate change. And you just have to be really passionate about climate change if you want to report on it genuinely. So we're hoping to go over there and really see the impact, see the realities of climate change and how it's impacting the communities over there.
Mm, so you're not there yet, but what do you know at the moment about the impacts of sea level rise, for example, in Fiji?
Well, we do know that a lot of families have lost their homes and their houses are pretty much on the beach now. It's a part of the beach because the sea levels are constantly rising and they're pretty much living on the water. And so I think it's important that we really show the realities of those impacts and show how these families are affected. And when we're really touching on those emotional sort of impacts, it really drives people to want to learn more about the impacts of climate change and how these vulnerable communities are living with the effects of climate change.
Great. Well, yeah, look forward to hearing about it when you get back. So now on to Jean for the latest news from the Asia Pacific region.
Hello.
Hi, how are you? How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How about you?
Yeah, pretty good. Mondays. At least we're on holiday, kinda. So last Wednesday, two education advocates visiting from the Philippines spoke at a talk about the struggles of delivering education to indigenous peoples in the Philippines. What's the situation over there?
Well, as I found out, it's pretty messy. There's a lot going on. So we had two volunteers, and they're named Fritzi Magbana and Lorena Segua from Save Our Schools Network, and they came and spoke about the challenges that they face while delivering education to the indigenous peoples, who are collectively known as Lumads, in the Mindanao region of the Philippines. So the Save Our Schools Network is part of community groups and advocates that are fighting for Indigenous people's rights to defend their land and the right to getting an education and the right to self-determination. So this network has 215 schools operating, and because the teachers are educating and therefore empowering the Indigenous Lumads, they are labelled as terrorists by the Philippines government, because this is seen as a challenge to the government's power. And aside from that, Mindanao is really rich in resources such as gold and copper, and this makes it a big attraction for multinational companies, mining companies, and these are welcomed by the government. So the government forcibly moves people from their land so that mining can start, and the government sends military personnel to flush out the people that are living there. So basically that's neo-colonialism, and it's a similar situation to what Māori experienced at the hands of Pākehā. So there's that kind of that connection there. And aside from the government military, there's also paramilitary forces acting in the area, adding to the violence and the tension in the area. So basically you've got the, you know, the government cracking down on education that empowers the Lumads, mining companies moving in, and military action in the region. So it's pretty messy. And according to one of the speakers, Fritzi Magbana, Save Our Schools, the network there, has documented 89 harassments of their schools, 18 military activities inside their school's vicinity, and 27 schools have been forcibly shut down because of the intensifying military presence in the area. Now, as the speaker, Fritzi, put it, the Indigenous peoples are now being empowered and educated because of the schools. And if they're empowered, they know their rights. So that means that they are a challenge to the Philippines government. Fritzi also had a lot to say about President Rodrigo Duterte, who was encouraging this violence. And Magbana said, in the first 6 months that President Duterte was elected, we were really hopeful for a change. You know, he was saying that he was a socialist and a leftist and a pro-Lumad and an anti-mining advocate. But in 2017, in November, when the APEC summit took place in Manila, President Trump visited the Philippines and Duterte seemed to change his mind. So after the visit of Trump, Magbana says that he changed his tune. He welcomed all the invested to extract the natural resources. So, Magbana says that he's a puppet. So it is a really messy situation over there, as you can tell.
And his extremely violent war on drugs as well. A lot of people were shit scared. But you're talking about how Duterte was claiming he was a leftist when he was fighting for power. But I also understand there are communist rebel groups fighting.
Yeah.
How do they play into the education and Indigenous issue, do you know?
Well, it's kind of, as I said, it's like a really messy situation with a lot of different factions fighting for their interests. So it can be hard to tell exactly what's going on. I'm not exactly sure what role they play, but there's a lot of military action coming from a range of sources there.
Yeah, better keep posted on that one.
Mm.
So in Papua New Guinea now, a group of customary landowners have regained access to the land following a legal victory against a Malaysian logging company. Good news. Tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, so a victory in that sense. So seven people from Pomeo in East New Britain were barred from entering their land for the past 6 years after a restraining order was issued against them in 2012. So the National Court in Kokopo set aside the restraining orders after finding that there was a lack of evidence. Now the dispute over the logging and land grabbing triggered the six-year legal battle between the landowners and local companies that were sponsored by a Malaysian logging company. Now, these landowners include Paul Pavel Soalria and Norbert Pames, who have been vocal against land grabbing and widespread deforestation in the remote district. Now, the Pomeo district is the site of a really controversial special agricultural business lease where large tracts of rainforest have been logged and replaced by palm oil plantations. So it really is a great victory for the citizens there without really realising their rights really to their land.
Yeah, often it's palm oil displacing people and rainforests and animals, orangutans. A lot of people get up in arms about orangutans, but less so for actual people, it seems. But yeah, let's hope a similar victory will happen to the people in the Philippines. And to wrap up today, there's a new band on the scene in Papua New Guinea. What makes this band so special?
Well, it's really cool, actually. So this band is called Girl Power, and it's an all-girl feminist band that is seeking to empower women in Papua New Guinea's music industry. So they played their first gig in Port Moresby this Saturday, and it's headed by a female artist called Miriani Masani and has seven members in total who are students, mothers, and there's also a lecturer in the mix. So aside from the human rights kind of issues that are in the Papua New Guinea, they're also braving a male-dominated industry to come out and not only sing but to raise awareness on social issues that are affecting women and girls. So they've previously toured in Goratuka and Madang, but this was the first time that they've performed in the capital. So they've also launched a music video, and that's dedicated to ending domestic violence in Papua New Guinea.
Great. Yeah, I think I'll try and track down one of their songs and play it later on.
Yeah. Give it a spin, eh?
Should be good. So yeah, that was Jean Bell, Hallie Ikemotu, and Bless and Tom. Thank you so much for joining us today in studio. And I hope your trip goes well. Yeah,
Thanks
for having us. Bloody exciting.
Yeah,
and
cheers.
Yeah, we look forward to the updates next week.
Cool, right, thanks
see you
very
later.
Much. Cheers.
That was the Southern Cross.
8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
That's right, you're listening to The Wire. The time is 38 minutes past 12. We just received a text. Force and control are the only tools in the Greens' toolbox, not realising that failure in their goals is assured. More freedom and a raising of consciousness is the only path to a healthy planet and society. Cheers, Peter. More freedom, less government. Thank you very much, Peter. Always enjoy your texts. But up next...
What are you even worried about? It's Worry Week on The Wire.
When Auckland Mayor Phil Goff campaigned for his post in 2016, he proposed a 10-cent levy on every litre of petrol to pay for significant changes to transport. Labour backed this in their election campaign last year. The first reading of the regional fuel tax bill happened in Parliament at the end of March, and it will now move to a select committee. I talked to Councillor Richard Hills about what this tax will do for our transport system, and I started by asking him where Mayor Goff's goal for a fuel tax came from.
Under the last government, we have a $6 billion hole in the ATAP, which is the Auckland Transport Alignment Project, which is the agreement we have with government and council on all the items that we'll fund, and those are usually 50% each, so council fund half, government fund half. We requested government to find some options. The last government said it was either a petrol tax or a congestion charge, which would take a long time. So the petrol tax was under Phil Goff's campaign. He said we'll keep the rates at whatever he said, and we'll also introduce a petrol tax. To do that, the government have to introduce legislation to allow us to have a regional fuel tax, and that will be to plug part of the gap. So there's, I think it's like a $24 billion transport budget that we need to fund over the next 10 years, and we, at the moment, we have funding for, we don't have funding for $6 billion of that. So the petrol tax fills $1.5 billion of the gap.
And originally the levy was going to be 10 cents a litre. Is it true that it will now be 12 cents?
So the regional fuel tax is still 10 cents a litre, but there is GST on petrol, and so it will be included, just like all the excise taxes that are ever put on petrol, they also include GST, so it means it's 11.5 cents extra per litre.
And you said that the levy will get us to 1.5 billion of the plan that Auckland Council has made in conjunction with the new government. What do those new plans look like, and how much will they change and shape our transport system?
Yeah, so the fuel tax was still based on the last government's plan. So even under the last government, there was still $6 billion we needed to find extra. And so that was to fill the gap of agreed projects. In the new government, there'll be another plan of agreed projects, which we know there's still a gap, which will be, I think, about the same as $6 billion or more. But the focus is quite different with the new government. Their focus is around public transport, rural roads, safety, like local road safety, down to even they're going to fund footpaths and walking and cycling for the first time as well. So that's in partnership with us as a council. So that funding will help us fund those priorities. But the vast majority for the road, people saying that we hate roads and all sorts of things, the vast majority of the funding still goes on to roads and highways and local roads and road safety, but there's a much more transformational focus on walking, cycling, pedestrian safety and public transport.
Okay, so as you've covered then, Auckland Council is sort of equally focused on improving public transport as well as motorways, I suppose. But in terms of public transport options, what change can we expect over the next 10 years?
Yeah, at the moment we haven't got the full project list back from the new government, but basically we're looking at things like a light rail network across the city.
Mm-hmm.
The government are looking to fund from the city centre waterfront out to the airport and covering through all those suburbs out there. They're also looking for rapid transport out northwest. We already have the Northern Busway on the North Shore, but they're looking to ramp up the amount of funding we get, maybe looking at better subsidies for public transport fares so they don't continue to rise. There's a number of initiatives, but also safety will be a massive part of that, as well as building on the City Rail Link, which is already underway. So it's really about safety. We're getting one person either killed or seriously injured in Auckland every single day. That's a pedestrian or cyclist. The road toll is rising and congestion is rising, and we don't have more space for more motorways. We need to get people into public transport and using the roadways more efficiently instead of just bulldozing homes every time we want to build another new lane or highway.
Mm-hmm. And how much collaboration does MacGough have with Minister Twyford on this project?
Yes, so the last year or so of the last government, we were building quite a good relationship under the last government too, and ATAP was a good sign of that. The new government's even more aligned with us, working with us as much as possible, making sure we're all on the same page, and making sure that we're using the money, taxes and rates and excises, everything to the best kind of ability. So we're all very much working in collaboration. The minister is in touch with the mayor and council quite often.
Okay, and in terms of recent public transport advancements, the mayor and the minister opened Manukau's new bus station on Saturday, and the first services ran through it yesterday. The build cost $49 million, and where did that money come from? Was that part of ATAP as well?
Yep, so anything that was basically a transport project from the start of ATAP, which was a couple years ago now, was built in. So that was one of the priorities in ATAP. It was $49 million, and that was in partnership with, I think the vast majority was Auckland Transport / the council funding, but there was a big component that was NZTA, which is the government as well. So it's obviously has a wide focus on connecting public transport, walking, cycling initiatives, drop-off points. It's connected to the train station, so it's about getting people from their home, from the train, to the bus, and to work, to school, to other local things, and getting people around the city. So it's just really good facilities in the south, connecting people. And the bus services go right across the south. I won't name them all, but there's, I think it's 470 buses a day expected to be going through there.
Right, and the idea for it has been in the works for 2 years. Who started that? Where did the initiative come from?
Okay, so it was the build was 2 years, and the initiative just came from the project list of, you know, we've had a lot of station upgrades, new bus stations, new train stations, and with the City Rail Link, we're getting more of that too. So it's a network across the city. This is just one of the ones that came up as a priority, as Manukau is a growth area, and we've already got a lot of people coming through the train station there, so it's just much easier connections to the city and to the suburbs through there.
That was Auckland Councillor Richard Hills talking about what Mayor Gough's proposed regional fuel tax will do for our city's transport system.
Worry Week on The Wire.
That's right, you're listening to The Wire. The time is 45 minutes past 12. Let us know your thoughts, 309-3879 for the call or 5395 for a text. Do you drive? Do you like your car? Do you like taking the motorway? Or you think, fuck that, it's all about buses and trains? Let us know. But up next is Lucy.
Before the UK entered into the EEC, the UK was New Zealand's number one trade partner, receiving 90% of exports. With Brexit nearing, could we see this trade relationship open up again, and what will that mean for New Zealand? In 2016, the UK ranked as the third biggest trade partner, making up 20% of New Zealand export and import. I spoke to Trade Minister David Parker to find out where the negotiations are up to right now. Pre the UK's entering the EEC, the UK made up 90% of New Zealand's trade. Since that, it has significantly dropped to 20% in 2016. With Brexit nearing on the horizon, what could this mean for New Zealand?
Since Britain joined the European Community way back when, New Zealand substantially diversified our export base increasingly to other parts of the world, including, of course, China, Australia, Japan, United States. Nonetheless, we've got strong traditional ties with the United Kingdom, and we would expect that post the divorce between the United Kingdom and Europe that our trading position with the United Kingdom will improve.
So how would this benefit New Zealand?
Well, we like to trade with countries that are in their respect for human rights, democracy, have similar respect for the rule of law, quite often similar health safety system, including at the border, to protect against the incursion of unwanted pests. So trade agreements with countries like that are very good for New Zealand because they give us more people to sell things that we sell to the rest of the world in order to get what we want to import, like our cars and our computers and our smartphones.
I understand that New Zealand has been in negotiations so far with the UK. What's the current status of these trade negotiations?
Well, until very recently, the United Kingdom hasn't been able to go too far other than express interest because they've got to complete their settlement with the European Union, now become apparent that they're not going to complete the terms of their pulling out of the European Union for some years, and in the meantime they're going to start their negotiations with other countries, and we would hope that those other countries include New Zealand.
So what are the main priorities for New Zealand and the concerns that you have going into these negotiations?
Well, New Zealand always likes comprehensive agreements covering all sectors of the economy. We have a very open economy when it comes to trade. We don't have high tariffs on anything, and we make our way in the world by doing what we do well, to sell to the rest of the world the goods and services that we produce well to pay for what we import. So we want a high-quality wide agreement with the United Kingdom. They have some sensitivities around agricultural export, as do other European countries. Some of those are based on understanding. We're not increasing dairy output significantly these days, so the idea that we would be swamping any country with increased dairy exports is wrong. It's really a distribution of where those exports go to.
There have been many issues with the TPPA agreement, like protecting New Zealand's interests, protecting property, New Zealand's property, and preserving New Zealand's sovereignty in these agreements. Do you think you're going to face similar issues with the UK?
It's very important to the Labour New Zealand First coalition that we properly protect the sovereignty of New Zealand to have appropriate environmental laws for the protection of fresh water and to reduce climate change. We've also moved to control the effect of wealthy people from overseas competing against New Zealanders to buy our homes, for example. So we would have as bottom line those sorts of issues. We're certainly not going to give up the sovereign right of a future or current New Zealand government to do what's in the interest of New Zealanders on matters like environment, tax system, controlling who owns our land.
As I said earlier, the UK used to make up 90% pre-1970s of New Zealand's export and trade. What's this going to mean for your other trade partners? Because the UK, I think, is currently the third largest trade partner. Could this rejig that?
It's highly unlikely that we will ever be as dependent on the UK for our exports as we used to be way back when we had 80 to 90% of our produce going there. But we would expect that our trade would increase to the United Kingdom and their trade to increase to New Zealand, which would be to our mutual benefit.
And the hot topic on everybody's mind, I think, at the moment, do you have any idea when Brexit will come to fruition and these agreements will come into force?
It's a little unclear where the United Kingdom negotiations with the European Union will end. And until they've got more clarity around that, it could be difficult for the United Kingdom to complete free trade agreements with other countries, because they will not know what level of freedom they have to negotiate their own terms and new free trade agreements, given the effect that that could have on their relationship with Europe. So there's some ways to go yet before we've got clarity around those issues.
And just one final question. What do you see this doing for New Zealand? Do you see it bringing New Zealand into a more prominent position in the market?
Look, Europe generally, including the United Kingdom, high value markets where they've got public institutions and good environmental standards. We'd like to have improved trading relationships with countries like that. They're a high wage economy, so New Zealanders readily see that more trade with them is not going to suppress wage levels in New Zealand. So it's a high priority for New Zealand to both improve our trading relationship with Europe and with the United Kingdom.
The Wire.
Sitting on the beach watching transnational criminal scum neoliberal filth.
That was Trade Minister David Parker talking about what Brexit will mean for New Zealand. Will this affect your business? Give us a text on 5395 or give us a call. Let us know your thoughts.
But up next, we've got a very, very special guest.
Yes,
he's made his way from the dungeons of Thursday, is it? Crawled up those glass stairs.
Yeah.
You get up here. What's the story on?
It's a bloody good one, actually. Yeah. So the New Zealand Dental Association's criticised the government, saying there's not enough funding and subsidies for people to get dental work done. People having to go to hospital, get teeth taken out, they just cannot afford the dental work. So I spoke with Dr. Bill O'Connor from the New Zealand Dental Association about this and what more the government can do on this issue.
I'm into that.
Yeah.
I got to go to the dentist.
Well, I haven't been for a year.
Oh, I haven't been for so long, but yeah, I'm terrified.
My dentist emailed me the other day and were like, Lachlan, we miss you.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, give me the $80 to go for the checkup.
Yeah, we miss your
How
money.
How badly do you miss
this
me?
This is my first year having to pay for it and I'm not excited.
It sucks.
Oh, there'll be older people listening.
And I got my wisdom teeth out 2 days before my 18th birthday.
Kids.
I got that free.
So. Mm.
Yeah. But yeah, you'll find out why it's not free.
Here we go.
So you've called on the government to increase subsidies for low-income people needing dental work. How does the system currently work?
Well, currently
dentistry is free up to the age of 18 for everyone. So, you know, up until that age, you don't have any costs. After that, it's largely private. Most people pay the full cost, but for people who are on low income or unable to afford treatment, there are various ways and means through WINS and possibly public hospital systems to enable them to get treatment.
Are these sort of subsidies, are they mainly for emergency work?
They are, yeah. They would apply pretty much exclusively to emergency work.
So do you feel this is an ambulance at the bottom of the cliff approach?
Well, it is an ambulance at the bottom of the cliff approach, definitely.
And why is dental sort of largely private? Why is it not in the public healthcare system as such?
It's a historical thing. It never has been in the health, you know, the public health system. Up to the age of 18, it's largely in the, well, certainly at primary school level, it's almost exclusively in the public health domain. At secondary school, there's a mix. But I guess the reality is, you know, if it's a pretty expensive treatment system, and it just hasn't been picked up or put into the public health system.
So what reforms would you like to see to the subsidies?
The New Zealand Dental Association would like to see the subsidies probably increased, but certainly more widely available for those who do need it. We don't see that, you know, it should be determined by an age or a range of ages, but it should be targeted to those that actually need it out there across the whole spectrum of the adult population.
And because dental work, I mean, it is so expensive, do a lot of people neglect their dental health?
That's one of the reasons some people neglect their dental health, but people neglect their dental health for all sorts of reasons. You know, even when it's free in the school system or up to the age of 18, up to 40% of secondary school kids are not enrolling or into the scheme and not availing themselves of free treatment. So, you know, for some people it's not a priority.
Because how important is dental health? Can poor dental health have other health consequences?
Definitely. Oral health is incredibly important. It's the, if it's not good, then you can have all sorts of other issues arise from it. It does affect your general health.
And currently, are dental costs regulated, or does it just really depend on which dentist you go to, how much you pay?
Yeah, it depends on which dentist you go to as to how much you pay. It's a free market out there, so costs do vary.
Could you ever see a time when, I mean, dental could be in the public healthcare system, or is it just something that is too expensive and the government will stay away from?
I think at the moment it is too expensive. No government, I mean, ideally they would like to go there, but I think the reality is that the burden on the health budget would be excessive, so they're not, but certainly not interested at the moment in expanding it too much.
And you also talked about people needing emergency work. They could go to the hospital or other public health providers. I mean, can you talk about this a bit?
Well, some of the DH...
Wire. Their relationships with their girlfriends or their wife. They shouldn't have more than one
wife at a time. Oh, I see. Sorry, you cut my interview short there. It's too good. You didn't want me to upstage you.
We'll go with that and not technical difficulties this time. Beyond the dentist thing again, how bad do you reckon your teeth are going to be, Lachlan? All those.
I'm putting it off because I don't want to. I eat a lot of, you know, a lot of sugary treats. But I do floss.
Partial to the sugary treats.
I floss every night.
How often?
Every night.
Every night?
Every night. Yeah.
Nah.
Yeah. But I don't use mouthwash because mouthwash is a myth. I'm a mouthwash truther.
Really?
It does nothing for you. Don't use mouthwash, people.
It tastes so good, though.
Yeah, it doesn't. Yeah,
it's
drink
horrible.
It.
It's like that gum.
It's how you start the day, you know, with a fresh mouth.
Oh, Jesus.
Yum.
It's like a shot of tequila or something. It'll wake you up.
Oh, yeah, some of them do come with alcohol. So
some people drink it.
Yeah. Yeah. But let's go to an ad break.
Marlon Williams is bringing all the bliss and ache of his new album, Make Way for Love, to the Auckland Town Hall in May. Dreamy. And you could be there. If you want to win tickets, all you need to do is stay tuned to BFM 95. BFM presents Marlon Williams at the Auckland Town Hall. With one show already sold out, don't shilly-shally. Get your tickets for Saturday, May 26th now. Tickets from Ticketmaster.
Glenn, what are you doing? You've been in there since 1 o'clock.
Mum, yeah.
What are you... Oh my God, Glenn, you're completely soaked in gin.
Mum, it's just music.
God, you're dripping eclectic tunes and handpicked vinyl everywhere.
Oh.
Do you even know what genres you've been trying?
Mum, it's genre free.
Sweet Jesus, come on, into the shower. You're sweating music everywhere.
The Tuesday 1 to 4 show with Gin. 3 hours of genre free musical exploration for your Tuesday afternoon. Right here on 95BFN. Sit back, open your ears, and let it all soak in.
That was The Wire.
Yes, that brings us to another Monday Wire, the best wire of the week. Thanks, producers Lucy and Mary Margaret.
Thank you, Ruben.
You're very welcome. And thanks to everyone who came on the show today. Manama Davidson, Trade Minister, or co-leader of the Greens, Manama Davidson, Trade Minister David Park, Auckland Councillor Richard Hills, Southern Cross with Jean Bell, Blessin and Halle, and lastly, Bill O'Connor from the New Zealand's Dental Association. Anything you two would like to add?
Just have a great week. Start it with some mouthwash.
Do it. And all those Auckland Uni students, enjoy your last week. But the AUT is getting 2 weeks starting next week.
So. Apparently they have a 3 week break, is what I heard. Do you know what? Mid-semester break, it's just hard to study. So take as little time off as possible.
But we have to bear in mind all those lovely folks that aren't at university who are thinking not very nice things about us right now, being on holiday all the time. Thank you for working so hard. We'll be there soon.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts.